I stop this? I ask Javier. I don't really expect an answer. He shakes his head.
Don't know that you can, he tells me.
Maybe it's time to consider getting out of this town for a while. Between the Beldeens and this documentary everybody's talking about.
Everybody's talking about it?
This is hot gossip in Norton, and it's bringing up a lot of old bullshit about you being guilty of murder. Some of them will jump on whatever paints you in a bad light.
Great. I suppose I should have assumed that. And how do I fight it?
You don't fight the sea. You leave until the flood's over.
He's uneasy, and that makes me uneasy.
Watch your back. I'll do what I can to cool things down.
We don't fist bump. We hug. I love Javi. I trust him, just as I do Kez. He's had my back from the beginning, since the day I walked into his gun range, and I know he'll do what he can. When they leave, though, I feel exposed and helpless. It makes me angry.
We stay inside for the day. I watch from the windows for the white van, the film crew, but they're not here. Not where I can see them, anyway. It makes me itch to think they could be hiding in the trees right now, filming me, filming our house. After a while, I try to concentrate on the book I'm reading, but I keep looking up, scanning the perimeter like I'm on a military post instead of my own porch, looking for the flash of a camera lens in the trees, or the flash of a sniper's scope. It feels like a normal day, but there's something underneath that I don't want to examine too closely. I call the kids in and propose a trip into town for cake and ice cream. They seem happy with that, though lately Lanny's been obsessing a little over calories. She just ran off about 1,000. I think she'll be fine. When we make the drive into Norton, everything still seems normal. There's an old man driving a tractor down the middle of Main Street, throwing clods of dirt in every direction. But that happens at least once a week. I creep along behind him until we make the turn into the first stop. We usually start at the ice cream store and finish at the cake place, but as I pull in and park, I spot a clean white van glide in after. It doesn't have any logos on the side, and from the sticker on the bumper, it's a rental. There are two people in the van, and as I turn off the engine, I keep watching them as they exit the vehicle and go to the back. I don't know what I'm expecting them to do, but when I see that the taller African-American man has a handheld video camera and the woman is plugging in a microphone, I realize exactly what's going on. It's the camera crew. They found us.
Mom? Lanny, who's got her door half open. Something wrong?
Close the door, I tell her. My tone makes Connor scoot back from his exit, too. Let's just wait a minute.
What's happening?
Connor starts looking around, and the cameraman fits the viewfinder to his eye. He's getting a good shot of the back of my SUV, including the license plate.
It's getting hot in here, Lanny says. Can we just go in and get some ice cream now?
No, I say. Sorry, but I think it's best we just go home.
Why?
From where they're sitting, they can't see the van. I might have told Lanny if we were on our own. My daughter understands things better than my son when it comes to our sometimes precarious social standing in town. But I'm not yet willing to ramp up Connor's anxiety levels. He's wound pretty tight. The terrible experience with his dad not long ago has made him even more introverted. I miss the days when he was still hanging out with geeks his own age, enthusiastic for games and movies and Dungeons and Dragons tournaments. I still think those things are inside him, but I don't think he feels safe anymore expressing them. Just another reason to hate my ex. Roast in hell, Melvin. Preferably on a slow-turning spit.
I'll tell you once we're home, I say.
I start the engine and back up. I have to pass the van to head for the exit, unfortunately, and that means the cameraman is perfectly positioned to see us. I have a faint hope that the kids won't see that. But of course, Lanny does, right away. She points straight at them.
What the hell are they doing?
filming us, I say. Put your hand down, please. My daughter does not put her hand down. Instead, she turns it and effortlessly raises a proud middle finger. Hope they got that, she says. Assholes. Why are they doing that? I don't want to tell them this, but it's best they're prepared. You remember the woman on the Howie Hamlin show? Miranda Tidewell, Connor says. She's rich. When we both look back at him, he shrugs. I looked her up. Since she was doing a documentary about our father, why is she doing that? People want to hear about him, unfortunately. And us. So we have to be careful. Yeah, Lanny says, which you'd realize if you ever got your nose out of your books. They're fighting again. I wish that they wouldn't, but I know that's the standard sibling relationship, especially at this age. Lanny did handle Connor with kid gloves for about 2 months after I came back from Kilman Creek and gave them the hard news about their dad's death, and that I'd had to be the one to kill him, which was hard. But the peace treaty never really lasts. In fact, there's even more of an edge to it now. We've talked it over, but I don't think Lanny can get over the idea that her brother was talking to their dad during that time. Melvin, damn him, had convinced our son to trust him, and Lanny just can't comprehend that. It's a wound between them, and I hope that eventually it will heal. But it damn sure hasn't yet. We're at the parking lot exit now, and unfortunately there's traffic coming in both directions, so I'm stuck. The cameraman has walked off to the side, still filming. I'm sure he's tightly focused on our faces. I hate it. It feels like a violation of our privacy, even if it's not technically against the law. Or maybe it is against the law? I don't know what the rules are in this state for filming minors without consent. Might be something to look into. I look at the oncoming traffic and wish everything would move faster. But there is yet another tractor rumbling toward us at an achingly slow speed. The dark eye of that camera at the periphery of my vision seems to get deeper, like the mouth of a well I'm falling into. I blink, and I see the camera in the Howie Hamlin studio, the feeling of being frozen and helpless. I blink again, and I see a filthy, moldering Louisiana mansion, a room spattered with blood, chains, and a camera. Filming. 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 Just like the camera Melvin had set up to show my murder to a waiting, paying audience of watchers. I hear what sounds like an approaching scream. Mom! Lanny's alarmed voice makes me mash the brakes, and I realize that I've drifted almost into oncoming traffic, and the scream was the horn of a passing truck. She rakes her black hair back from her face and gives me a worried look. Are you okay? I'm fine, I automatically tell her, because that's what I always tell her, and myself. But it doesn't take a paid psychologist to figure out that I'm not okay. I'm having flashbacks, cold sweats, nightmares, and now this filming, bringing it all back. I need to talk to Dr. Marks. I take a couple of deep breaths and whip the wheel left when there's a break in traffic. Out of the corner of my eye, I see the man angle his camera to follow our path. I don't really feel safe until we're over the hill, turned onto the main highway, and headed out of Norton. Lanny fidgets in silence for a while, waiting for a fuller explanation I'm not willing to give. She finally puts her headphones on and stares out the window. Connor drops into his book and vanishes from the world. I'm glad for the silence, until Lanny shoves her headphones aside and asks, "You're not going to get married again, are you?" Well, that comes out of nowhere. "Honestly," I say, "I doubt it." "Even to Sam?" "Even to Sam." "Why not? Are you guys breaking up?" I don't want this discussion. I glance around. Connor doesn't seem to be listening. "We're not breaking up," I tell her. "Nothing's changed. It's just, I'm happy where we are, is all. I don't think there's any reason to be pushing it, do you?" "As long as you're not breaking up." She shrugs as if she doesn't care. I know better. She likes Sam a lot, And most of all, she likes how Connor is with Sam. It takes a lot for my son to trust people, but when he's with Sam, I see a kid who feels like he's normal, seen, loved by someone with whom he feels safe. It's pretty special and very necessary. So I say, Sam's always his own person, Lanny, and he makes his own decisions. But I don't see him leaving us anytime soon. If I do, I'll tell you. Lanny just shrugs again, as if it doesn't matter to her. Headphones go back on. We're almost home when I get a phone call from Sam. He's made it home. Everything okay? I ask. Fine, he says, but with such crispness, I wonder. You heading home? Yes, I'm not far. Why? Because we had a note on the door. A film crew was here looking for you, he says. Also, we're out of oregano. Note? Film crew? I repeat. At least I don't repeat oregano. Jesus, they're getting bold. I just spotted them in town, too. He's silent for a few seconds. We probably need to talk about this. Probably. I'm not looking forward to that talk. Or the other one that we need to have. All through the evening, I can feel it sitting between us like a stone wall, and I want to reach across it, feel him reaching back. But I don't know if I should, or if that's even possible right now. Time, I tell myself as we silently do the dishes, me washing and Sam drying. Give him time. But time could drive him away. And I don't know how to do this. Nobody prepared me for how terrifying being in love, really in love, could be. My landline phone rings, derailing me, and I'm caught between irritation and relief. I dry my hands and grab it because I recognize the number on the caller ID. It's Marlene, from Wolf Hunter. I get silence after my somewhat brusque hello. Noise on the line. Breathing. I'm about to hang up when I hear a young woman's voice say, "Help me." I pause, uncertain. "Hello? Who is this?"
"V," she says. "Vera Crockett. Mama said you help people, and your number was in her phone."
The accent is familiar, and so is the last name. Marlene Crockett was the woman who called me after the Howie Hamlin disaster, who clearly had something on her mind, but couldn't bring herself to say what it was, who'd wanted me to pick up and drive to a nowhere town to discuss it in person. I'm instantly on guard. Using a kid? That's low. I have to resist an urge to hang up. "Put your mother on the phone, please."
"I can't," V says.
She sounds strangely flat.
"She's dead."
"Excuse me?" I'm turning to look at Sam, instinctively, lips parting. I shake my head to tell him I don't know what's going on, but the tone of my voice has alerted him to something odd.
"When? What happened?"
"You should come," V says. "They're going to get me soon, too. She's dead on the floor, and they'll come for me next."
"Vera? V? Are you saying that your mother is on the floor right now?"
"Yes."
I feel the world shrink around me, reality condensing into the voice on the phone.
"Okay, I need you to call 911, V."
"If I do that, they'll kill me."
She sounds calm, but terrifyingly disconnected. I don't know what I'm dealing with here.
"Shoot me down like a dog right here."
I gesture to Sam, cover the mouthpiece, and say, "Get on the phone with Kezia. Tell her to get the Wolf Hunter police over to Marlene Crockett's house. I don't know what's going on, but the daughter says her mother's dead." He doesn't hesitate or ask questions. He grabs his phone and walks off to the corner to make the call.
"V,"
I said. "Your mother, can you tell if she's breathing?"
"She's dead."
No affect in her voice. None at all. Shock? Something else? I don't know. "Can you check for a pulse for me?"
"She's dead."
For the first time, I hear emotion. It's exasperation, and it jolts me.
She's on the floor, and...
I hear V. Crockett hesitate, go silent. When she speaks again, she's whispering.
They're coming back.
V?
V?
She's put down her phone or dropped it. I hear something like footsteps or banging, and then an ear-shattering bang that makes me flinch and stare at the mouthpiece, as if expecting something to come out of it other than sound. I conquer that impulse in another second and put it back to my ear.
V! Vera! Talk to me! What's happening?
Sam's still on the phone, watching me. I raise a hand helplessly. V. Crockett isn't talking, but I can hear something. Movement? Distant shouting? Something like that. And then, suddenly, her flat, calm voice is back.
That sent him running. Vera, what just happened?
I fired the shotgun, she says. Right through the door. Guess that one's heading right for the hills.
Are you okay?
Yes.
V?
I don't know what else to do but keep her talking.
V, your mom said that she was worried about something. Was it about you?
No, she said. My mama's never worried about me. Well, if she did, she sure gave up a while ago. Can't really blame her.
None of this makes sense. I don't know how to read this young woman.
V, how old are you?
15,
she says. That hurts. I close my eyes briefly. I have a daughter your age, I tell her. I know I'd do anything for her. I'm sure your mother felt that way too. I swallow hard. I need to keep her talking. God, she's just a baby.
Tell me about your mom, V. What happened the last time you talked with her?
I don't remember, V says. Doesn't matter now. She's dead.
She's dead, and I...
She doesn't finish the sentence, but I feel a sick, crawling sensation. Was the end of that sentence, and I killed her? Marlene had been so vague about what was happening. She'd mentioned nothing specific, but maybe she'd been loath to admit she was scared of her own daughter. That would be an awful thing to face. I hear something in the distance. Sirens. V, are you still holding the shotgun? I ask her.
Yes.
I need you to do something for me, I say. I keep my voice calm, assertive, and caring as I can manage. Sam hangs up his call and comes to stand across from me, drinking in my expression, my body language. There's nothing he can do, though. This is all on me. I want you to put the shotgun on the floor. Do it now, please. I hear movement, rustling, a heavy thunk.
All right, V says. I did that. But they're going to shoot me anyway. They've been itching for an excuse.
They won't, I say. Now I want you to open your front door, hold up both hands real high, and stand there on your porch. You have a porch, don't you? Most people do in the rural South.
Yes'm, she says. But if I go out there, they're going to shoot me dead.
I promise you they won't if you raise your hands high.
If I do, I can't hear you on the phone, she says,
perfectly reasonably, yet still with that odd, flat lack of emotion. Can you put me on speakerphone?
Oh, sure.
She does. I hear the change in environment, the way the world opens up into an indistinct fog around her.
Okay, I'm going to the front door.
Shockingly, she giggles.
Man alive, I punched a hole clean through that thing. I can see all the way through.
I'm sick, thinking that there might also be a dead person on the porch on the other side of the door, but I don't say that. I just say... Okay, please open the front door, slowly, and raise both your hands. Are you doing that, V? I hear the creak of hinges. V's voice comes more distant now.
Yes'm.
Step out slowly and keep your hands up. This is the moment. I hear the sirens outside wailing to a stop. I hear car doors opening. I can close my eyes and imagine it in a spinning 360 degrees. V on the porch, the hole blasted in the door behind her, someone wounded on the ground, maybe, or even dead. Two, no, three now, police cars, which must be the full complement of Wolf Hunter police, gathered around the place. Officers with guns drawn, nervous and ready to fire.
"Drop it,"
one of them yells, and I realize he's mistaken the phone she's holding above her head for a weapon.
"Drop the phone, V," I tell her.
"Okay," she says, calm as a winter lake. I hear the phone fall, an impact. Then three beeps, and the call goes dead. There's not a lot of discussion about what to do next. I try calling the number back. It just rings and goes to an automated robotic greeting. I can picture the phone hitting the porch and shattering. And even if it didn't, it'll be in an evidence bag shortly, and no one will answer. Either V. Crockett has been shot, or she's in handcuffs right now. 15 years old. I'm shoving a couple of changes of clothes into a duffel bag as I talk to Sam. "I have to go," I tell him. "Her mother called me for help, and now I'm in this as a witness whether I go or not. V called me before the police came. They'll need my statement on the record. I don't want them coming here and making a scene for Miranda's film crew to record." I see Sam flinch at that, or maybe just at the mention of Miranda.
"You don't know that will happen."
"I do," I tell him. "These documentary people are circling like vultures, and they will seize on this if the police roll up to our door. Better if I handle it away from home." I want to talk to him about Melvin's note in his sister's journal, about the awful shock of that and the emotional wreckage of last night. But I know that this has to take priority. He shuts the bedroom door behind him. "Gwen, stop." I pause at least. I look up at him, restlessly folding and refolding a shirt. "You're a target," he says. He walks to me. "You can't put yourself in the middle of something when you've got no idea what's going on up there." "I can't leave a 15-year-old girl out there by herself either. She called me," I tell him. "Her mother's dead. If it was Lanny..."
"But she isn't Lanny. She isn't," he says.
He puts his hands on my shoulders, and I ache to be pulled into an embrace. But he doesn't do it. He holds me there at arm's length.
"You can't take on trouble in a strange town. You don't know the players or the people, and you've got no stake in this thing."
"But I do." I meet his gaze, and he blinks first. "Sam, I know you're just looking out for me. I know the risks. I know. I'm not that much safer staying here. Leaving and avoiding the cameras, I have a second of bone-deep panic, of losing my breath. I'm back in Louisiana, in a room with a camera and blood and a dead woman and my brutal ex. I'm on the Howie Hamlin stage, trapped in a nightmare. If I face another video camera right now, I'll lose it completely."
"God damn it," he says,
but he's not angry, just resigned. He leans his head against mine, foreheads gently touching, then lips in a sweet, quiet kiss, as if I hadn't shattered him just last night.
"Okay, but you're not going alone."
"But the kids..."
"The kids go too," he says. "We all have to go, or you don't."
What he's not saying is, we go as a family. But I feel that. I need that. I kiss him again, more fiercely, and feel his hands drift up to cup my face. He brushes hair back from my forehead and looks at me like I'm something he's trying to memorize. Then he steps back. "I'll tell the kids to get packed." The kiss still lingers on my lips, makes me tremble inside, and I want more. It scares me. I never expected to find this. Not here. Not with him. But Sam Cade is never what I expect, moment to moment. I want to heal the gulf between us. I need to. I have the oddest feeling, though. I feel like he's relieved. Like he wants to escape Stillhouse Lake right now as much as I do. But where are we going? Connor asks as I watch him stuff way too many books in his bag.
Someplace cool?
Probably not, kiddo, I tell him. A place called Wolf Hunter. He pauses. I can tell he's never heard of it.
It sounds cool.
I don't know, I've never been there. But it's at the edge of the Daniel Boone. The Daniel Boone National Forest is a huge swath of dark forest, and just saying it sets a mood. Connor's eyes widen. We've been there, of course. It was one of the first things I did with the kids when we moved here.
Are we camping?
He asks. I sure hope not. There ought to be a motel we can stay at. I'm hoping it's just for a day or two. He hesitates, then packs another book. I have to hide a smile. He's as bad about that as I am about self-defense equipment. The collapsible baton in the bottom of my bag weighs at least as much as 3 of his paperbacks, and it's far from the only thing I have in there.
Why are we going?
He asks. You remember the lady who called me the other day for help? He nods. Her daughter's in trouble.
How old is she?
Lanny's 8.
Oh, I thought maybe it was the other girl.
What other girl? I ask.
The one from the TV show.
He picks up his phone and calls something up. He hands it to me. On the screen is a picture of a beautiful little African-American girl of maybe 6 or 7, smiling for the camera and bursting with charm.
Remember? Her parents were on there. She was kidnapped from her school. They were in the waiting room with us.
I remembered now. The traumatized couple in Howie's green room. I'd barely registered them at the time, so intent on fleeing that I didn't care about anyone else's reasons for being there. I'd just wanted out.
Oh.
I sit down on the edge of Connor's bed.
How long has she been gone?
Almost a week now, he says. She's probably not coming back, right? I don't want him to know these things. Not at his age. But statistically speaking, he's on point. Most young children who are abducted don't survive more than a few hours.
Didn't I hear there was some kind of ransom demand, though?
The details are filtering back to me. Abducted from her school in a slick, organized effort. Not an impulsive, need-driven act, but a planned and orchestrated one. That doesn't mean the girl is alive, but it indicates she has a better-than-average chance to survive. Connor's eager to catch me up. He's clearly been following the case.
The discussion boards say that the dad paid the ransom, but nobody knows for sure, he says. So maybe there was a secret payment to get her back?
Back up, Connor.
Discussion boards?
Some of the brightness fades out of him.
Sorry, but I don't go to the ones that talk about my father, I promise.
Don't go to any of them, I tell him. And you know you can't believe what you read on Reddit, I say.
Stay off the boards, okay? I don't post, I only read.
Don't make me put them on the block list, Connor. He gives me a frown.
I'm not some little kid, but you never want me to know anything.
I don't. Earnestly. Not about child abductions, and certainly not about the depths of horror that human beings have in them. Not about his dad, though I know he already knows much more than I think. I want you to know things. I also want to be sure you're ready for it, I say, and mean it. I don't want you to get a warped view of the world, either. Not like mine. People are good most of the time, bad some of the time. Rely on the internet for how you look at the world, though, and you'll see the worst side of people represented far too much.
That's not true, Mom, he says. People put together big movements on the internet. They help each other. Strangers help strangers. It isn't all bad.
He's right, of course. My son's more well-balanced than I am. Okay, but I mean it. Do not fall for things that feel right and sound wrong. Understand?
Like the lies my father was telling me, he says. Yes, I know.
I'm sorry, sweetie, I tell him, and he looks down at the book he's turning over in his hands. He shouldn't have done that to you. He shrugs, a loose circle of his shoulders.
Yeah, well, it wasn't as bad as what he would have done to you, probably.
I blink. I see a cold, black camera lens focusing on me. My throat tightens up, and I know I'm going to have to deal with this trauma sooner rather than later, and in a more constructive manner than pushing it away. But right now, there's a girl in Wolf Hunter who's all alone. A dead woman who asked me for help. I'm sorry about the little one, I say. I wish I could help her, too. But first we're going to see what we can do for this girl, okay? He nods and adds more books to his already overstuffed bag. Connor builds his walls out of stories. As far as coping goes, he could do a whole lot worse. I have. I check on Lanny. She's already packed in one backpack, less than what I'm taking. She's pacing in the living room, arms folded, and when I say her name, she jumps and turns with a smile that I know isn't real.
Hey, don't sneak up on me like that.
She seems genuinely distressed.
Are you okay?
I ask her. That sets her back a step, and I see her put up her sarcasm shields to full strength.
Oh, sure. I'm super okay with a sudden trip to nowhere to do nothing when I thought I was going to see Dahlia tomorrow. You know how much I wanted to do that, right?
I'd never leave her on her own, but I do briefly consider leaving her in the care of Dahlia Brown's mom, Mandy. Except that if Lanny and Dahlia are having trouble, putting the two of them in the same house for a day or two might shatter that relationship for good. I don't want to be responsible for that. So I say, absence makes the heart grow fonder.
Such bullshit.
Lanny.
Yeah, okay, fine. Let's go already.
My daughter has nerves and edges, and I wonder why. I want to ask, but I know her. This isn't the time. She doesn't want confidences. She wants to be on the move. I leave her pacing, gather Sam and Connor, and head back for the living room and front door. We all stop when the doorbell rings. Sam's closest to the monitor. He steps back to look at the camera feed. It's Kezia, he says, and I open the door. Kez looks tired. She nods to me, and I step back to let her in. She embraces Lanny, bumps fists with Connor, and the kids are genuinely glad to see her. I'm not sure I am. I close and lock the door and cast a glance at Sam.
Yeah, so I thought I'd better come by, she says. Y'all are going out there?
It's not a huge deductive leap. The four of us carry bags. We are, I say. I'm half expecting her to object, but she looks relieved.
Good, because my little chat with Wolf Hunter PD didn't go so well. Good old boys seem to have declared this case open and shut, but they want you to get up there to give them a statement. Not just about what happened tonight, but why you were in touch with the dead woman in the first place.
She wants to ask, but she also knows better. Kezia understands the kind of people who call me for help and what their situations usually are. Dire. She wouldn't want to discuss it in front of the kids.
Call me when you get there, she says instead. Not sure I trust these officers.
If we were alone, she'd call them a whole lot worse.
Seems like there's only a couple of lawyers anywhere near Wolf Hunter, so I texted you numbers for them. If you don't want to memorize them, put them on your arms in permanent marker.
It's a precaution taken by activists at marches. I start wondering exactly how bad a vibe she got from the Wolf Hunter cops and what the hell I'm risking dragging my kids into. I look at Sam, and I see the same reservations, but he's not going to let me go alone, and I'm not leaving them here to fend off this video hit squad that Miranda Tidewell has sent to destroy what's left of my reputation. Whatever comes in Wolf Hunter, we'll handle it the way we've done everything. Together. I let Sam and the kids go ahead of me out to the SUV. I hand Sam my duffel as he passes, and he nods. He knows that I want a more private conversation. So I shut the door and turn to Kez.
You didn't tell me these so-called documentary filmmakers were in town when we came to see you, I say.
Why not?
I'm a servant of the public when I'm at work, she replies. They weren't breaking any laws, and honestly, I didn't see setting your temper on fire would do anybody any good. You go at them, you'll just make their case. They'll win a bunch of awards and your life turns to shit. Just stay away. That's the best thing you can do. Don't give them anything to work with.
She's right, of course. That's another reason why it's good to get out of town, I say. Because I can't guarantee that if they shove a camera in my face, I won't shove it up their asses.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was afraid of. She studies me. Sharp as broken glass, just like her father.
You still seeing that therapist?
Why? Does it show?
Not to most people.
You went through hell, Gwen. Give yourself a break. Let yourself heal up before you get yourself into another fight.
I appreciate the concern, but you know I don't even have a choice.
She shakes her head.
Just try to keep out of trouble, please. You know I'll back your play if I can. So will Javi. But there's a line I can't cross, and you're going to be way outside my jurisdiction.
I know, I tell her. We hug. Two women wearing shoulder harnesses under our jackets, which says a lot about how we view the world.
Watch your back.
You too.
I set the alarm, lock up, and head for the SUV as Kezia walks to her boxy, city-issued sedan. She trails us down the road to where it splits, right for the exit to the highway, left to keep heading around to the other side of the lake. Her headlights disappear off the other way, and we stop at the highway. Sam looks at the navigation on the phone mounted to the dash.
Hour and a half out, he says,
glances at me in the light of the dashboard.
You sure?
I'm sure, I tell him. Let's go. As we leave Stillhouse Lake, I feel a tiny, guilty bit of relief. Like I'm running away from my problems, dumping them and escaping into the unknown, the way I had before. But it's false, that feeling. Escaping was always temporary. Problems always caught up to me. But, I remind myself, I'm not doing this for myself. Not this time.
The roads out to Wolf Hunter are narrow and winding, and despite the moonlight, very dark. Headlights seem to go dim on these roads, and I'm glad Sam is driving, not me. The trees close in on either side until they're a solid mass. It feels claustrophobic. We hardly see another car or truck along the way. A couple pass us, flooring it past the speed limit, and a few more head in the opposite direction. An 18-wheeler rounds a curve swinging wide, and Sam slows down to let it clear out. This isn't a road friendly to large trailers. It's hard enough in a well-driven SUV. There aren't any working gas stations, just a couple of spaces hacked out of the tree line with empty, weathered buildings and faded signs. We don't see much of anything else. Lanny opts to nap, head resting against the side window behind Sam. When I check the rear-view mirror, I see that Connor is reading a book by the light of his phone.
You'll ruin your eyes doing that, I tell him.
He doesn't even look up.
That's not even close to true, he says.
Says who?
Science.
Hey, can you do me a favor?
Connor looks at me, a little frown wrinkling the skin between his eyebrows, which are now raised.
What?
Look up Wolf Hunter and see what you can find out about the town.
He puts his book down.
Seriously?
Yeah, seriously. I'd like to know what we're walking into. You're one of the best researchers I know.
Wait, one of the best?
Well, okay, maybe the best.
That pleases him, though he doesn't want me to see it.
He puts the book away and starts tapping on his phone at lightning speed I can't even hope to approach with my older, broader fingers. Sam looks over and gives me a smile. I return it. Making Connor feel useful is important. He spent so much time second-guessing himself recently. Getting his head into something else is good. Sam's smile fades, and he turns his attention quickly back to the road. I know he's hurting inside,
not just from what's between the two of us, but from that damn journal. Melvin wouldn't have arranged for it to be sent if it hadn't been a time bomb designed to harm, even destroy. And I don't know what it said. I suddenly wonder if Sam brought it with him. The thought actually frightens me, that something Melvin's defiled might be traveling with us right now, like a parasite waiting to take hold inside us. I can't ask. I can't start this conversation here, with the kids. Motel 6 looms out of the darkness, like a neon oasis to the left. It's not in Wolf Hunter, but it's close, a couple of miles from what looks like the center of town, such as that might be. We make a turn and Sam parks in front of the office. 2 rooms? He asks. I nod. Preferably with connecting doors, I tell him. For sure, next to each other. I don't think that'll be a problem, he says. There are only 4 cars in the parking lot, and most likely one of them belongs to whoever's working the front desk. It's a modest-sized place, just 1 level and no more than 15 or 16 rooms set in an L-shape around the lot. No swimming pool, but I think most motels have done away with them for liability reasons, and I don't want my kids attracted to lounging around one anyway. Be right back. He slides out and walks into the office. I wait, watching him inside through the dim glass, and I'm startled when Connor suddenly leans forward and says too loudly, Mom! Oh, come on, volume control, Lanny moans, and pulls her hoodie over her face. What the hell? I turn to look at my son. He's ignoring his sister completely, totally focused on me. He holds out his phone, and I take it. He's pulled up a blog. True crime something. I don't really pay much attention to the site's title once I recognize I'm going to be dealing with an amateur's opinions, until I read the headline on the blog entry. Second woman missing in Wolf Hunter, Tennessee. Cover up? Okay. It has my attention. I start reading. As you might recall, late last year I covered the case of Tarla Dawes, an 18-year-old woman who left her trailer in the sticks outside of Wolf Hunter, Tennessee to get groceries, and vanished into thin air. Dawes had a history of drug abuse and more than a little tension at home. The police were quick to dismiss it as a voluntary departure, though how she departed with just a second-hand purse and no extra clothes is a question the Wolf Hunter PD, such as it is, seems to want to avoid. Tarla's mother doesn't believe that Tarla would have left of her own accord, even though there are plenty of reasons to believe that Tarla and her unemployed 19-year-old husband were on the verge of divorce. At least 1 domestic violence call is on record. But what 18-year-old disappears without posting or texting a friend? At least calling her mother. Now we have a second young woman gone. Bethany Wardrip, 21. Another one with a troubled history, some arrests, nothing unusual for around Wolf Hunter. Drug possession, public intoxication, disturbing the peace. She griped to a co-worker that night that she wanted to leave this town and never come back. Did she? Bethany didn't own her own car. She often walked or hitchhiked with friends and neighbors, but no one reports seeing her that night or giving her a ride out of town. Bethany, like Tarla, left with only a purse. Her clothes still hang in her closet. Her 3 extra pairs of shoes, an old pair of Converse high tops, a heavy pair of hiking boots, and a pair of worn black high heels were all left behind. More significantly, so was a coffee can found in her small kitchen cupboard with a roll of cash inside, $462. That's a decent amount for a woman who works for minimum wage. The careful savings of a woman who bought little, and according to those who knew her, rarely went out with her old crowd. Maybe it's just me, but I feel like something's rotten in Wolf Hunter. I read through it twice and feel my heart rate speed up. This blogger could be onto something. Maybe it's the same thing that Marlene felt she needed help with. I don't know how or why that might have led to this horror show with the daughter, but this feels like something. Thanks, baby, I tell him. This is good information. I know it is, he says, with not a small amount of smugness.
Told you I could find stuff.
Yes, you can, I tell him.
That's your job from now on, okay? Head researcher. Tomorrow I want you to find out if there's any more posted about either of these two ladies, okay? Tomorrow, not tonight. Don't stay up. Promise?
I promise, he says. Can I borrow Lanny's laptop?
Ask Lanny, my daughter says without taking the hoodie off her face.
I'm right here, doofus.
Okay, he immediately says and turns to her.
Can I borrow your laptop tomorrow?
No.
Mom?
It's your sister's laptop, I say. If she doesn't want to help find missing young women who might be in trouble, that's her business. That brings Lanny bolt upright, clawing the hoodie back and glaring at me.
Mom, that's not fair.
If the two of you work together, you can get things done. You always do, I say. I'm going to have to be at the police station tomorrow. Sam will stay with you guys. I know he'd appreciate the two of you getting along for the day.
We get along, Lanny says. Mostly.
Work together. That pleases neither of them on the outside, and both of them on the inside. Lanny rolls her eyes. Connor sighs. I know they'll seize the chance to do something useful for me. Sam comes out of the office, gets back in the SUV, and moves it into place in the parking lot. The headlights shine directly on two doors, numbers 5 and 6.
Okay, Sam says, and holds out a key to Lanny.
Wolf Hunter hasn't progressed to modern electronic key cards. It's an elongated plastic tab with the room number on it.
Lanny is the keeper of the key.
Lose it, you both chip in for the fine. Got it?
We won't lose it, Connor says. Why does she get the key?
I'm older, she says, and takes it.
We're in 6, so you're...
We'll be in 5, he says.
Breakfast at 8 a.m., okay?
Do we have to hunt for it out in the woods?
Lanny sighs.
Bring home a squirrel or something?
There's a McDonald's half a mile down. But if you want squirrel bacon...
Ew, no, gross, Sam.
We make sure the kids are stowed away and locked in before we take the room next door. It does have a connecting door, and I make sure it works before I can relax. At least there's no arguing from the other side.
2 beds. He says, romance isn't dead.
There's nothing familiar about the room, and yet it reminds me strongly of one we shared many months back after Melvin's escape from prison, before things ended in the green hell of a tumble-down mansion. This one is clean, neat, utterly plain. I put my duffel bag down with my purse. Sam has tossed his bag on one of the beds and is unzipping it to get out his toiletry kit. I sit in the single, stiff armchair, crowded in the corner next to the air conditioner. It's just blowing out barely cool air.
Do you want me to ask? I keep the question calm and soft.
I won't if you don't. He freezes and is suddenly intent on the kit he's holding.
About what?
Jesus, Sam, really?
I keep my voice low. My kids are right next door, and I definitely do not want them to hear any of this.
You know exactly what I mean.
Yeah, he says. It sounds grim.
Meaning?
Meaning I want you to ask, but I don't.
I stand up, take the leather bag from his hands, and put it on the bed. Then I put my hands on his cheeks, the stubble sharp against my palms, no space between us.
What did he write in her journal?
I swore I'd never want to know anything else about Melvin Royal, especially when he was dead and buried in an unmarked pauper's grave. But Sam needs to get this out like an infection from a wound. I've got the name of the person who might have sent it, and we'll put a stop to any more of Melvin's posthumous torture. He pulls me into an embrace, as if he wants to keep me sheltered from what he's about to say.
He gave me the whole story, he says. How he abducted her. How she fought back. How long she...
My mouth goes dry, because it's as if Melvin knows, even dead,
what will hurt us most, what destroys us. Stop, I tell him, and turn my head so that my lips are resting on the soft skin just beneath his ear. Sam, this is what he wanted. Did I tell you that one of the detectives who interrogated him committed suicide 6 months later? That's how toxic Melvin was. Like breathing nerve gas. You can't let him inside, Sam. You can't. Everything he wrote down could have been just his sick, lurid fantasy. We can't know. We shouldn't know. And I wish to God you hadn't read it. I feel the breath he takes in. It's like a hand grasping for a life preserver. I had to, he says. Everything he said feels true, Gwen. If she went through that level of pain, I don't know what to do about it. He's dead. I don't have anywhere to put this sickness. I'd wept through the medical examiner's testimony of each of Melvin's victims at my own trial. I'd forced myself to listen, to know what they'd suffered at the hands of a man who sat at my kitchen table and slept in my bed and was the father of my beloved children. I'd forced myself to endure it the way their families must have. I already know what happened to Callie, and it had been bad enough then as a clinical report. I've never heard it in Melvin's own emotionally predatory words. He'd revel in the details, in every word choice. Put it on me, I tell Sam. Tell me. We sit side by side in the blank, empty motel room, and he tries. Outside, the sky is dark over the trees, the stars blaze, and I stare at that view with tears welling up and dropping cold down my cheeks. It's awful, listening to the quiet rage of what Sam is feeling and what Melvin did. I wish it was beyond my comprehension, but it's so familiar. I can picture every step of it, every cut and scream and horrific detail. After he's done talking, he's short of breath and shaking. I wish we had drinks. I feel filthy and heavy and unspeakably sad now, but I know it was important for him to share it and not to hold it by himself. Despite our best intentions, Melvin is still reaching out from the grave to hurt us, and I don't know when that will stop. That's probably his plan, to make us dance to his tune for as long as he can. Maybe the man in Richmond is the end of it, and maybe there are more of them. Melvin always did have fans. The last thing he wrote, Sam says, was that she begged him to kill her. Begged him for hours. He recorded it. He says he'll send me the tape. He swallows. I'm talking like he's still alive. But he must have planned this out. And there's somebody out there mailing things for him. So it's like he is still alive. I flinch. Because once again, Melvin's found some unspeakable cruelty to inflict. I wait until my voice is steady. And then say, I found the name and address in Richmond. Kez is on top of it, and we'll stop him from doing more damage. Melvin hoped to make you his last victim. Don't let him do that to you. He nods slowly. I'm not sure he can resist. After a few silent moments, he stands up, gets his toiletry kit, and goes into the bathroom. I hear the shower start. I lie back on the bed and stare up at the ceiling. It's clean, no water stains, which is a wonder. I hate this. I hate that Melvin is standing invisibly between us, grinning like a skull. I strip down to a light tee and panties and climb into bed. It's so hot and humid that I toss the comforter back and leave just the top sheet. The shower runs a long, long time. It's easier to stay in there. I remember all the times I tried to wash away the pain, the guilt, the unspoken rage. He needs to feel clean again, but I doubt he'll find it in the bath. When he comes out, finally, I hear him stop for a moment, trying to see if I'm asleep, I think. So I say, "It's okay if you want to take the other bed. I understand." He switches off the light that sits between the two beds. I feel his weight settle in next to me, then the gentle heat of his body as he moves close. I'm on my side and I look back at him, then turn to face him. The kiss he gives me is gentle, almost regretful. I curl up against him, never mind the heat of the room, and his skin smells like the lemony motel soap that will always, from this moment on, remind me of grief and loss. We hold each other in the dark and we don't talk. I'm almost afraid to breathe. There's something so fragile between us that the slightest tap might shatter it. It might be the most intimate we've ever been.
After the promised morning breakfast and an argument with my daughter about whether or not pajama pants are appropriate for McDonald's, Sam drives us into Wolf Hunter. It's not much to look at, after all. The downtown, well, the whole town, really, is just about a 10-by-10 block grid, with dirty fronted shops along the main drag and faded clapboard houses leaning beside rusted fences. It looks like a town that long ago surrendered. I doubt if more than 1,000 people call it home. The only real virtue to it is that it's close to the large, lush national park, so I suppose the transient visitors keep the place on life support, if not alive. The main street contains the same you see in every southern small town, a junk accumulation masquerading as antiques, a kitschy tourist store with lots of Confederate flags and bumper stickers designed to offend, a cafe that proclaims best pies in Tennessee, and is probably lying. Pickup trucks and old SUVs with bumpers wired on, and nothing that's been washed in a year. Judging by the weather-beaten look of everything I can see, there's a paint shortage. Keeping up appearances requires some kind of aspiration. The police station is just one street off the geographic center of town, a storefront operation that reminds me of old westerns, complete with a hand-painted star on a big plate glass window. Not exactly the hardened, terrorist-resistant bunker of modern urban centers. After my shower this morning, I took Kez's advice. I wrote phone numbers on my inner forearms in black permanent marker. It seems like a little too much paranoia, but better too much than too little. When I walk into this place, I'm essentially stepping into a dark room without a flashlight. I don't know who to trust. I don't even know if there's going to be a floor underneath me, metaphorically speaking. Best to be prepared for a fall. Sam parks right in front and says, "I'm your one phone call if you end up needing one, right?" "And my bondsman," I say, and try for a smile. I don't feel too good about this suddenly. "Okay. Everybody get back to work on Operation Wolf Hunter. I'll call when I'm ready to leave the station. Deal?"
"Deal," Sam says, and kisses me. He brushes hair back from my face. "Be safe, Gwen."
"Be safe," I tell him in return. And then I lean over the seat and kiss my kids before sliding out into the thick, humid air of morning. The smell of the trees is powerful, overcoming any kind of car exhaust. There aren't that many cars on the road. It's a good smell at first, but then when I become accustomed to it, there's a dark undertone of dead things rotting under leaves, of a stagnant river ripe with mosquitoes. I'm not imagining it. This town smells like death. I try not to breathe deeply and manage to smile and wave at Sam and the kids as he backs the SUV up into the street. I watch them until they're up over a hill, heading back toward the motel. There are a few people on the street, and I realize I'm drawing stares, or glares. It's hard to tell the difference, but they're definitely noticing me. I push open the door to the police department and head inside. The reception area is small, barely the size of my living room. There are some old wooden chairs up against the wall and a bench that started life as a church pew. There's also a wooden counter, and a woman sitting on the other side of it typing away on a computer that's just barely aware of the internet age. She's 50-ish, white, with no-nonsense graying hair, perfect makeup, and cat-eye glasses. "Help you?" she asks without stopping her typing.
I'm here as a witness, I tell her, for the Marlene Crockett case. The key clicking stops. She spins her chair to face me, studies me with care, and then rolls forward to reach a phone.
What's your name, sugar?
I resist the urge to tell her not to give me endearments when we just met. Gwen Proctor. She recognizes the name. I see the slow blink, the sudden shift in expression, like a castle gate coming down.
Have a seat, she says. I'll let the detective know.
I claim one of the wooden chairs, which look marginally more comfortable than the bench. She murmurs things I can't catch into the phone, hangs up, and gives me an entirely insincere smile.
Just 1 minute, she says, and goes back to her computer.
If she's got email on that thing, she'll no doubt be spreading word of my arrival everywhere. I'm glad I have the numbers of lawyers on my arms. I have no idea what might happen in here. They probably won't charge me with a crime, but I've learned the hard way that being innocent doesn't mean handcuffs don't go on. It's something less than a minute, all in all, until a solid old wooden door in the back wall opens, and a man comes out who has to actually stoop to pass underneath the top of the frame. I stare, which I imagine isn't an unusual thing, because he's got to be approaching NBA heights. 6'7", 9", maybe even more. Thin, too, with long legs. He must have his suits custom tailored, because this one fits him well. It's light gray, a concession to the heavy heat.
Ms. Proctor, I'm Detective Fairweather, Tennessee Bureau of Investigation.
He holds out a hand as I get up, and I feel miniaturized when we shake. He's careful and professional about it. His skin's the kind of pink that doesn't take to the summers around here, and his hair's Nordic blonde, cut military short.
How are you, ma'am? I hope that drive wasn't too difficult.
I have to give him points for using Ms. instead of Mrs. or Miss. I usually have to correct people at least once. His accent is definitely Southern, but not so much Tennessee. Virginia? Hard to say. He holds the door open for me and gestures me inside. I don't immediately obey. So you're not actually with the Wolf Hunter police? I ask him.
We're working together on this, he says. I'm the lead investigator. After you, ma'am.
He's painfully polite. I suppose that should comfort me, but instead it makes me warier. But I don't have much choice. He's not going to let me walk out of here without a conversation. I go past him and into a narrow, dim hallway. It's as scuffed and beaten up as I would have expected. He leads me into a room off to one side and shuts the door behind me. Typical interrogation room. I settle on the side that I know he wants me to take, the one that captures me best on video. Might as well be cooperative when it's easy. Detective Fairweather takes the chair on the opposite side of the small table and settles on it like he's afraid it might break.
Ma'am, you don't mind if I record our conversation, do you? It's for my records.
He puts his cell phone down. It's entirely unnecessary, unless the camera isn't working properly, or he's afraid Wolf Hunter PD might not be entirely reliable. I nod in reply, and he presses the red button on the screen.
Okay. So, just for the record, ma'am, please state your name.
I'm Gwen Proctor.
Originally Gina Royal, wife of Melvin Royal.
Cheap shot, detective. That's my former married name, yes.
And just for context, ma'am, where is it you live?
On Stillhouse Lake, near Norton.
In Tennessee?
Yes.
And do you live there by yourself?
No, I say. I have 2 children, Lanny and Connor, and Sam Cade also lives there.
Sam Cade?
He leans forward now, resting his long forearms on the table and lacing his fingers together.
And lives there how, exactly?
I'm not sure I understand the question. I do, perfectly. But I want him to ask straight out.
Is he renting a room from you, or?
We share a bedroom, I tell him. I suppose a more normal thing to say would have been, we're lovers, or we're partners. But even now, I hate to push it that far. Dumb, I suppose. It doesn't matter how carefully I parse my words, because the detective gets exactly where I'm going.
Well, that's a little unusual, isn't it? Considering your ex-husband brutally murdered his sister?
I let that sit for a long few seconds. My silence has thorns. When I do answer, my tone's gone sharp and, against my will, defensive. How exactly is any of this relevant to what I heard on the phone? Fairweather holds up his hands in either surrender or apology.
Apologies, just background questions.
No, that was a deliberate ploy to throw me off balance, and we both know it.
Okay, let's go ahead and move on. I need to ask you some questions about Marlene and V. Crockett.
Don't know them, I say. Absolutely true. I force myself to relax. Body language speaks as loudly as words, especially on camera. Cameras. I glance involuntarily up toward the one set in the corner. It's disguised, but not very well, with a paint job to match the bland walls. There's no lit-up indicator to show whether or not it's recording, but I can still feel its blank, impersonal stare. I blink back images of nightmares and try to focus directly on Fairweather again. He's asked me a question I missed.
Sorry? You did speak to Mrs. Crockett, we know that. That call she made to you went on a bit. Wasn't just a wrong number.
I didn't say she didn't call me. I said I don't know her. His straw-colored eyebrows round up.